with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The biggest ever data leak in history has exposed hidden offshore assets worth millions of dollars, allegedly tied to 35 current and former world leaders and more than 300 other public officials from over 90 countries. Nearly 3 terabytes of data, dubbed the Pandora Papers, were leaked to the Washington-based International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Over 600 journalists helped review 12 million documents leaked from 14 financial services companies. Jordan's King Abdullah, a close U.S. ally, was reported to have used offshore accounts to spend more than $100 million on luxury homes in the United Kingdom and the United States. The papers also accused the family and close associates of Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev of corruption, suggesting that they've traded close to £400 million in UK property over the past 15 years through a network of offshore firms. The papers have also implicated the Czech Prime Minister, presidents of Ukraine, Cyprus, Kenya, and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, among other high-profile figures.
Because people don't want to solve it. It's very simple. I mean, first of all, bear in mind, the central banks around the globe have opened up their money spigots to extraordinary levels since the 2008 financial crisis. So as a result, you have tons and tons and tons of capital circulating around the world, unregulated, looking for the highest profit levels, etc. And the banking sectors are making lots and lots of money over this.
While having offshore firms and accounts isn't illegal, the papers allege that some of the companies have helped officials hide their wealth, practically enabling them to evade paying taxes, while some others have used them for money laundering and other fraudulent financial schemes. According to the Pandora Papers, over a dozen U.S. states are providing financial secrecy services that rival those of offshore tax havens in Europe and the Caribbean region. The documents single out South Dakota, which has allegedly sheltered billions of dollars in assets linked to people previously accused of financial crimes. The investigation says South Dakota state lawmakers have adopted lax regulations drafted by trust industry insiders, measures that have quadrupled customers' trust in the state compared to 10 years ago. Some of the trusts cited in the probe are linked to people accused of human rights and labor abuses. The revelations come despite President Joe Biden's pledge that Washington will lead the efforts internationally to promote financial transparency and fight against corruption.
Now, the U.S., for example, talks about equalizing tax rates, shutting down tax havens, etc., etc. But in fact, individual U.S. states have been opening their doors wider and wider to these kinds of activities. South Dakota is one example, Nevada is another, and a third is Delaware, a small state on the East Coast, which is home to Joe Biden. And Joe Biden's history, he essentially is a product of this anything-goes, hot-money corporate culture.
The rich and powerful people cited in the large-scale investigation have already begun to deny wrongdoings and in some cases express readiness to undergo scrutiny. What's for certain is that they have a lot to answer for in their respective countries for the months or even years to come.
Iran has long voiced concern over the covert presence of Israeli regime's proxies as well as Daesh terrorists near its northwestern borders. Tehran says the terrorists were brought into the region at the height of the 2020 conflicts between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Iran particularly accuses Israel of hatching plots in order to sow discord among Muslim nations, saying the regime sees its survival through creating insecurity. On Friday, Iran's army ground force launched a military drill codenamed Khaybar near the country's border with Azerbaijan and Armenia. The drill was attended by armored, artillery, drone, and electronic warfare units with aerial support from the Army's Airborne Division. Islamic Republic's armed forces regularly hold military exercises to increase their military prowess and preparedness. The drills also send a clear and powerful message to enemies against any acts that challenge Iran's security, sovereignty, and territorial integrity. On Sunday, during a virtual ceremony held for graduates of military academies in the capital, Tehran, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, warned countries against the consequences of relying on foreign powers to guarantee their security. Ayatollah Khamenei said the interference of foreign actors in the region is a source of discord and damage, calling on the regional states to follow the example of Iran for power and rationality.
Israel considers Iran its mortal enemy and will do whatever it can to strengthen any of Iran's neighbors and try to draw them away from any kind of alliance with Iran. So that's partly what this is all about. Now, Iran, of course, has every right to have military exercises in any part of its country that it wants to. So the fact that it's having them in its northern border near Azerbaijan is not surprising.
Iran has long criticized Azerbaijan's military ties with Israel, which include purchases of Israeli arms such as drones and other weapons that helped Baku gain the upper hand in the war with Armenia last year. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute think tank, Israel provided Azerbaijan with some $825 million in weapons between 2006 and 2019. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has expressed Tehran's concern about Israel and terrorist elements threatening the security of neighboring Azerbaijan. The Iranian diplomat highlighted the importance of mutual relations between Tehran and Baku in the context of neighborly relations and expressed dismay over the recent negative statements by the Republic of Azerbaijan. Last week, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps held a separate military exercise in the northwestern province of Ardabil. The drill drew criticism from Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, who said he was surprised by Iran's decision since it hadn't held maneuvers in the region for about three decades. However, Iran's foreign ministry reacted to Aliyev's remarks, saying the drill was meant to secure regional peace and security. Iran's foreign minister said Tehran will not tolerate Israel's presence near the country's borders and will take due measures against the regime's activities.
United States and Israel support anti-Iran terrorist groups. The United States openly supports the MEK, which is an anti-Iranian terrorist group. So the goal, of course, is to start a war that the Israeli regime and the U.S. regime would be able to say is the responsibility of Iran. This is not the case at all.
But why should Tehran hold a grudge against Tel Aviv? It has been an open secret that Israel, along with the United States, have been responsible for several instances of acts of sabotage against Iran's civilian nuclear program over the past decade. Also, Iran blames Israel and the U.S. for assassinating its top nuclear scientists in order to hamper its eye-catching advances. Israel also sees this as an opportunity to act against Iran militarily, although indirectly. Any moves that prompt secession from Iranian territory is something Israel welcomes. Yet, in Iran's eyes, that is just a pipe dream, as relayed through its military exercises. The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has also said that holding military exercises by a state within its territory is part of its national sovereignty. The January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol during the Congress meeting to certify Joe Biden's presidential election victory revealed the deep division within the American society and political system. Now, months after the incident, a new poll has showcased the extreme divisions between the two major U.S. political parties that are Democrats and Republicans. To find out how deep the divisions run, the University of Virginia Center for Politics and Project Home Fire surveyed 2012 voters during the summer. Half of the participants had voted for Donald Trump and the other half for President Joe Biden. Not surprisingly, the results showed a country at ideological war with itself. The responses supporting the idea of forming two new countries out of red and blue states range from at least somewhat agree to strongly agree. Indeed, 52% of Trump voters and 41% of Biden voters expressed support for cleaving the country along political lines. The poll also found that 80% or more of both Biden and Trump voters fear the effects of the other party's policies. As a matter of fact, they said the opposing side presents a clear and present danger to American democracy. In addition, roughly 2 in 10 Trump and Biden voters strongly agreed with the idea of a president bypassing Congress or courts to take needed actions.
The real issue here is the weakening of democracy in the first place, which helps support or enable these notions of secession or mutual hatred.
Furthermore, a June poll found voters saw political division as the top issue the United States faces, beating out the COVID-19 pandemic, healthcare, and economic issues. If not dealt with properly and swiftly, the extreme division in the U.S. could turn into a full-blown crisis with dangerous ramifications. It could lead to incidents such as the January 6th attack on Capitol. On that day, a large number of Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol, where the U.S. Congress was meeting to certify Biden's presidential election win. Over 500 people have been arrested in connection with the attack. Also, about 140 officers from both the Capitol Police and the D.C. Department were injured. 4 people died in the attack, including a senior police officer. The U.S. also faces another challenge that is gaining steam, a national divorce. A Texas pro-independence group named the Texas Nationalist Movement is trying to push a referendum vote on the independence of the state, dubbed Texit. Also, support for the secession of California from the U.S., named Calexit, is rising. As of September 2020, the California pro-independence groups got approval again to collect petition signatures.
It's dangerous because what you have is one-third of the population who are increasingly convinced that the government is illegitimate. And when you have that, you also now have the mobilization of a section of these people to attack the very instruments of government.
Violence and secession are two probable outcomes of the continuation of the current trend within the U.S. political system. It's high time Washington came up with a plan to heal its fractured democracy, or watch its house of cards burn gradually.
The United States has seen several high-profile incidents of police violence and brutality in recent years, whose victims are mostly members of minority communities in America. The death of African-American George Floyd in May 2020 sparked a new wave of widespread protests not only in the U.S., but across the whole world. Following the incidents, A group of researchers has collected data about police killings in America over the span of about 40 years. The study published in the peer-reviewed Lancet Journal has found glaring discrepancies between figures reported by a governmental database and those compiled by open-source databases. According to the article, over half of all police-involved killings in the country have been either misclassified or unreported. Moreover, the researchers found that the governmental database misclassified nearly 60% of all fatal police encounters involving African Americans. The database is also reported to have missed 50% of all police-involved deaths of Hispanic people. The disproportionate police targeting of African Americans has been highlighted in previous research. However, the latest meta-analysis is considered as having the longest study period to date. Possible conflicts of interest have also been cited in the extensive research, as the authors noted that investigators are embedded inside police departments and can be discouraged from determining that the deaths are caused by police violence.
The U.S. government, the Department of Justice, these bureaucracies within the U.S. state are going to do everything they can to hide these because it's already bad. And the U.S. wants to maintain its veneer of being a progressive, a woke, a haven of social justice and international community.
The paper highlighted the importance of increased use of open source data collection to investigate acts of discrimination by the U.S. police. Targeted changes to policing and safety protocols were also cited as possible solutions to the increasingly pressing problem. In reality, however, many U.S. politicians seem to remain opposed to such changes. Last month, bipartisan talks in the United States Senate for a police reforms bill broke down without a deal. The bill was passed in the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives in March. The reforms, dubbed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, were proposed following the death of the African-American man at the hands of a white Minneapolis officer last year. The law would have banned chokeholds and qualified immunity for law enforcement. President Joe Biden accused Republicans of rejecting even modest reform.
They have something in stake in, you know, arresting disproportionately African-American communities. They have something in stake, be it personal prejudice or be it economic gain.
In such a political climate, the rising trend of killings isn't likely to be reversed anytime soon. That won't be good news for President Biden, who has a strong base of black voters.
In the limelight. Safety advocates have pushed for years for federal rules that would strengthen oil spill detection requirements and force companies to install valves that can automatically shut down the flow of crude in case of a leak. The oil and pipeline industries have resisted such requirements because of the high cost. Now, the recent oil spill has spurred renewed calls for an end to offshore drilling in California. We now present you an article written by Gabrielle Cannon. The piece is titled, U.S. Officials Knew of California Oil Spill 12 Hours Before Cleanup Began. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Records show that more than 12 hours passed after American officials were notified of a sheen on the water off the coast of Southern California before a response to the Huntington Beach oil spill began. Questions are now arising over why the response took so long and how that might have intensified the ecological disaster taking form on the Orange County coastline. Roughly 126,000 gallons of heavy crude oil seeped into the ocean off Huntington Beach over the weekend in a suspected leak from an underwater pipeline, splattering the beaches with black. coastal fisheries in the area are closed to commercial and recreational fishing. And the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, declared a state of emergency late on Monday. County prosecutors and federal agencies are considering charges and lawsuits. Oil is no longer reportedly leaking from the pipeline, but a cause has not yet been determined. U.S. Coast Guard officials said on Monday, 4th of October, investigators are looking into whether a ship's anchor might have struck a pipeline on the ocean floor. Amid a global supply chain crisis, more ships are waiting offshore than usual to access California's ports. The pipeline connects to an offshore oil production platform named Ellie, which is connected by a walkway to a drilling platform named Ellen. The platforms and another nearby platform are in federal waters and owned by the Houston-based company Amplify Energy Corporation. Before sand berms could be completed and booms, floating barriers that slow the spread and help contain oil spills were deployed. The toxic oil washed into the protected marshlands and endangered species habitats. Dead birds and dead fish were reported along the shoreline as animal rescue organizations rushed to the scene. So far, officials said three blackened birds had been recovered and were being cared for. A pelican, its feathers irreparably tarred, had to be euthanized. It's too early to fully assess the full ecological impact of the disaster, but scientists with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife are taking samples of the sea and sand. The area is expected to see an influx of migratory birds in the coming weeks, which could increase the toll. John Villa, the executive director of the Huntington Beach Wetlands Conservancy, which operates three protected marshes, said, "It is heartbreaking. All of them have been affected." He said, "You go through a whole lot of work and effort to buy the property and restore the wetlands. You maintain it and try to keep it as pristine as possible. And then this happens." Crews with the Orange County Public Works Department worked throughout the weekend to create a berm blocking more tarnished water from entering the preserve. But by then, some oil had already seeped through. According to officials, by Monday afternoon, 4th of October, roughly 4,158 gallons of oil had been removed from the water, and 8,700 feet of boom had been deployed to corral the oil slick. Beaches in Huntington and Laguna were closed, along with Newport Harbor and Dana Point Harbor. "It may be months before they are reopened. It's unclear how much damage could have been prevented if action had been taken sooner." Martin Wilshire, the chief executive officer of Amplify Energy Corporation, the company that operates the rig, said at a news conference on Monday that the company discovered the oil spill on Saturday morning, 2nd of October. Lieutenant Commander Jeannie Shea of the Coast Guard also said the agency hadn't been notified of the disaster until Saturday. But state oil spill records reviewed by the Associated Press show that the oil spill was sighted on Friday evening, 1st of October. According to the state report, a foreign ship anchored off the coast witnessed an unknown sheen in the water near their vessel at 6:13 p.m. local time on Friday afternoon, and the report was called into the response center just after 8:22 p.m. local time. Lonnie Harrison, Jr., Vice President of Colonial Compliance Systems, which works with foreign ships in U.S. waters to report oil spills, said one of his clients had reported the sighting. About 6 hours after the first report was received, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported that the satellite imagery spotted a possible oil slick more than 3 miles long. The report by the National Response Center, NRC, noted that there had been many vessels nearby, but none were clearly associated with the oil spill, and that prevented possible identification of a point source. But it continued, "The National Response Center report allows for high confidence that this was oil." Regulations enforced by federal and state institutions require rapid reporting after an oil spill. Oil companies have failed to comply in the past, leading to criminal prosecutions against Plains All American Pipeline, which caused the coastal oil spill near Santa Barbara, California in 2015, and Southern California Gas Company for a huge well blowout later that year. Amplify Platform submitted a spill response plan in 2016, noting the requirement for immediate notification of federal officials when more than one barrel of oil is released into the water. The oil platform, known as Ellie, was supposed to be equipped with an automated leak detection system that would sound an alarm whenever a change in the flow of oil is detected, alerting a control room staffed around the clock. According to the company's plan, which warned that a rupture in the pipeline could cause substantial harm to the environment and that in a worst-case scenario, 3,111 barrels of oil could be released, the alarm was designed to sound within 5 minutes for a large leak and 50 minutes for a smaller one. Meanwhile, the Orange County District Attorney, Todd Spitzer, is assessing whether state charges can be brought against the company, even though the leak occurred in waters overseen by the U.S. government. Officials said other potential criminal investigations were being pursued by the U.S. Department of Justice and Coast Guard and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. A federal lawsuit has also been filed by Peter Moses Gutierrez, Jr., who claims he was exposed to the contamination that washed up on the beach. Safety advocates have pushed for years for federal rules that would strengthen oil spill detection requirements and force companies to install valves that can automatically shut down the flow of crude oil in case of an oil leak. The oil and pipeline industries have resisted such requirements because of the high cost. Now the disaster has spurred renewed calls for an end to offshore drilling in California. The U.S. Representative Mike Levin has introduced legislation to ban new releases for oil or natural gas development and production on the Southern California coast. In his bill, he notes that, along with threats to habitats and marine life, the area beaches are a boon for a local economy, accounting for roughly $42 billion and 600,000 jobs for fishing, tourism, and recreation industries in San Diego and Orange counties. Those activities have also been threatened by the oil spill and the closures, which will likely stretch for weeks. U.S. Representative Mike Levin said in a press release in May, "The Southern California coast is home to world-renowned beaches, cherished marine life, and billions of dollars in ocean-based economic activity that are central to our quality of life, but are threatened by offshore drilling. Oil spills from offshore drilling have done devastating damage to our coastline before, which is why Californians overwhelmingly support a ban on new drilling activity along our coastline."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, do productive works. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Man's life is based on productive works, including agriculture and various forms of business and industry. Most industries would not be meaningful without agriculture because they gain their raw materials from it. In addition, agriculture is less prone to fraud and trickery because its results are governed mainly by natural factors and sincere efforts of men. On this account, cultivation and tree planting is labeled to be the most pure and pleasant work in the tradition, where Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam has said, "Cultivate and plant trees. By Allah, people have not done any action more lawful and purer than this." Brothers and sisters, with these occupations, everybody has to have an occupation, right? These occupations, which are less prone to dishonesty and fraud, are to be selected by the believers. Unfortunately, today, in the name of occupation, in the name of jobs, in the name of, trying to earn my halal living, people are not conscious about this very reality that no matter what occupation you choose, you have to make sure that that occupation itself, that business itself, it's free from impurities. You have to know what the boundaries and the limits of Islam are. You are a believer, you want to comply with the commandments of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. One of those occupations is agriculture. Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about productive works and selecting an occupation. You know, sometimes we are not that sensitive about what kind of occupation we are selecting in our lives. We just want to make sure that we are earning enough to be able to support our family, just have enough finances so we can live a decent life. But this is not where it ends for a believer. A believer is expected to search for occupations that are less prone to corruption, less prone to dishonesty, less prone to fraud. Some occupations, unfortunately, in today's time and age, they are, no matter what you do, they are full of corruption. Just the occupation itself. So for instance, the regular general politics, for instance. Somebody goes into that, they know that they will have to lie. They would have to give people false promises. And I'm talking about, of course, the Western liberal democracy politics, as we see in the world today. Which politician can you vouch for that has not lied in their tenure or before the elections? So for a believer, it is very important that you make sure that if you're trying to find a job or you're trying to study at the university and aiming for occupation and a field of study that you have to select, make sure that it is something that is going to keep you away from being disobedient to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Sometimes people, they choose a field of study and then later on they go like, oh, I don't know what to do. I know this field is corrupt, but I'm stuck now because my bachelor's and my master's and my doctorate is in this particular field of study, which is known to be corrupt. So brothers and sisters out there, the youth, you're listening, right? So make sure that the occupation and the field of study you select, it is something that enables you to get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and comply and be obedient to His guidelines. dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell, a Republican leader in the Senate, has a long record of tying debt ceiling increases to policy demands. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Jonathan Weissman and Emily Cochran. The piece is titled, As the U.S. Hurtles Towards a Debt Crisis, What Does McConnell Want? Stay with us for more. U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, has a long record of tying debt ceiling increases to policy demands. In March 2006, as the government veered dangerously close to a default, Senator Mitch McConnell, the number two Republican at the time, let the Bush White House know he was two votes short of what he needed to raise the legal limit on federal borrowing. Andrew H. Carr Jr., then the White House chief of staff, began working the phones. He soon found two Democrats willing to break ranks and vote to put the legislation over the top. But instead of thanking him, the Senate leader grew irate. Mitch McConnell had been hoping to extract concessions from President George W. Bush as the price for uniting Republicans around lifting the debt limit. "I don't need your votes," he snapped at Andrew Card. He lifted the debt ceiling with Republicans only. Andrew Card never learned what the Kentucky Republican Mitch McConnell wanted, but he tells the story for a reason. Senator Mitch McConnell has long used the periodic need to raise the government's borrowing limit as a moment of leverage to secure a policy win, as have leaders of both political parties. But 2 weeks before a potentially catastrophic debt default, Mitch McConnell, now the minority leader in the Senate, has yet to reveal what he wants, telling President Joe Biden in a letter on Monday, 4th of October, "We have no list of demands." Instead, he appears to want to sow political chaos for Democrats while insulating himself and other Republicans from an issue that has the potential to divide them. Mr. McConnell has said the government must not be allowed to stop paying its debts. He has also said he will not let any Republicans vote to raise the debt limit, while moving to block Democrats from doing so themselves. He plans to do so again on Wednesday, when the Senate will vote on whether to take up the legislation to raise the debt ceiling until December of 2022. If any Republicans object, it will take 60 votes to move forward, meaning that 10 GOP senators would have to join Democrats in doing so. No one really expects those Republican votes to materialize. Mitch McConnell has prescribed a single alternative for Democrats: use a complicated budget process known as reconciliation to maneuver around the Republican filibuster that he refuses to lift. "They need to do this, they have the time to do it, and the sooner they get about it, the better," he said on Tuesday. He even seemed to taunt Democrats a day after President Biden told Republicans they need to stop playing Russian roulette with the U.S. economy. Mitch McConnell, in his signature deadpan, looked into the television cameras on Capitol Hill to implore Democrats not to play Russian roulette with the American economy. Hardball tactics by Republicans on the debt ceiling are not new. Showdowns in 1995 and 1996 shut down the government but also helped foster a balanced budget agreement. A new Republican House majority in 2011 pushed the government so close to default that Standard & Poor's downgraded once unassailable U.S. debt, but it also produced the Budget Control Act, which crimped spending for years. The 2006 showdown has been used by both political parties as an object lesson. Mitch McConnell has pointed to it to show that partisanship is nothing new. Among the no votes on the debt ceiling increase that year were Senators Joseph R. Biden Jr. and Barack Obama. Democrats point to what they say is the more obvious lesson. They let the vote go through on a narrow majority with no filibuster. The same can be said for partisan debt ceiling increases passed in May of 2003 and November of 2004. This year is different. Not only are Republicans refusing to vote for the measure, they're creating an obstacle to stop Democrats from pushing it through themselves. There's still time for 10 Republicans to join us, no matter what some of the extremists and the hard right think. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the majority leader in the Senate, pleaded the day before the Wednesday vote to move to his debt ceiling bill. Senator Angus King of Maine, a moderate independent, sounded despondent. There's no bargaining, they're just stamping their feet and saying no. He added, it's a qualitatively new level of irresponsibility. With no overt policy demands to be met as the price for cooperation, Democrats say for Republicans, the chaos is the point, or at least a vague hope that the latest legislative crisis will somehow undermine Democrats' ability to fulfill unrelated parts of Joe Biden's agenda, especially an expensive bill to combat climate change and revive the fraying social safety net. Democrats are preparing another staggering taxing and spending spree without any Republican input or support, Mitch McConnell wrote on Monday. Bipartisanship is not a light switch that Speaker Nancy Pelosi and leader Chuck Schumer may flip on to borrow money and flip off to spend it. Given that the switch is currently off, he argues, Democrats have only one path forward. The Senate Budget Committee must produce a resolution that includes instructions to raise the debt ceiling, which must then pass the House and Senate, and weather a barrage of hostile amendments. Then the House must draft a vote on a separate bill to lift the debt ceiling, which would then go to the Senate, where it could not be filibustered, but would again have to survive an onslaught of politically difficult votes. Any proposal could be considered, and if any were adopted, the measure would be forced back to the House. And they have fewer than 14 days to do it. Democrats are left to seethe at their opponents' tactics. Mitch McConnell is singularly focused on winning control of the Senate in the 2022 midterm elections, full stop, said Senator Chris Van Hollen, Democrat of Maryland and a longtime budget expert. To his mind, that means using every tactic at his disposal to cause President Biden to fail, even if that hurts the country. Mitch McConnell has another powerful political incentive for his stance. He cannot control his members and is reluctant to risk the ire of Republican base voters by leaning on senators to smooth the way for a debt limit increase. Even if Mitch McConnell wanted to allow one to come to a majority vote, a single senator could stop it. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who has made no secret of his presidential ambitions, said on Tuesday that he would block any such agreement, even one to expedite the process that McConnell is demanding. Mitch McConnell appeared to acknowledge his own tricky political position on Tuesday when he said that ending the filibuster threat would require getting consent from every single Republican, and he added, I can't imagine that would happen. Senator Roy Blunt, Republican of Missouri, said 40 to 45 Republicans would be willing to agree to allow a debt ceiling increase to come to a vote, as long as they did not have to cast a public ballot. The problem, he said, was the other five. Senator Brian Schatz, Democrat of Hawaii, seemed almost relieved that Mitch McConnell had not put Democrats in a position where they would have to give in to conservative policy demands to stave off a Congress-imposed economic catastrophe. I have learned over many years that we cannot negotiate over things like whether or not to destroy the economy, Mr. Schatz said, adding, American politics has gone crazy because one party has gone crazy. With each passing day, the crisis becomes less avoidable. Each day, Democrats decline to give in to Mitch McConnell's demands to use the reconciliation process makes it that much more difficult for the maneuver to be completed in time to avoid a debt default. And each day, the Democrats demand that Republicans blink. They reply that Democrats are to blame for not using the process of reconciliation when they had time to do so. You still have time before you get to the edge of the cliff, Mr. Katz said, of the current debt ceiling showdown, and that time should be used for dialogue. How will it end? One option that Mr. Van Hollen said Democrats might have to pursue, and that President Biden on Tuesday called a real possibility, is changing the filibuster rules so the borrowing limit increase and any in the future could pass with 50 votes. Mr. King, who has been unenthusiastic about changing the rules, said he had to agree. I have been very reluctant for 9 years about modifying the filibuster rule, especially when it comes to policy, but this has nothing to do with policy, he said. This is about keeping the United States and the world out of what could be a severe recession.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Ridha in the speeches of the leader. The 7th of September 2014. The beginning of the imamate of the 8th Imam, God's greetings be upon him, coincided with the dictatorial rule of Harun al-Rashid. This happened after the martyrdom of Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam in prison. Anyone who showed the slightest disobedience towards the wishes of the ruling system faced unrelenting pressures. It was in such circumstances that the 8th Imam alayhi salam was appointed to imamate. There is a narration which says, one of the followers of the Imams alayhi salam said, This young person, the son of Musa ibn Ja'far, has accepted an important responsibility. This narration mentions blood trickles from Harun's sword. It was in such harrowing circumstances that Imam Ridha alayhi salam became an imam. In such difficult circumstances, this great personality managed to develop, among the Muslim society of those days, the bright line of the Holy Prophet's sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam's tradition and Quranic Islamic teachings. He managed to help hearts become closer to the school of the Holy Prophet and his household. Then it was Ma'mun's turn, and the story of his attempt to bring that great personality from Medina to Marv and to Khorasan. At that time, Marv was the capital of the Abbasid rule. They had changed the capital from Baghdad to Marv. Later on, they made Baghdad the capital city again. Baghdad was the center of Abbasid policy. The motivation behind the decision of Ma'mun and his ruling system to transfer the 8th Imam alayhi salam to Marv requires a long discussion. Ma'mun had made a calculation which was purely political. His policy was to strengthen the bases of his power and to weaken the movement of the Holy Prophet's household, God's greetings be upon all of them, and what they wanted to do. In the face of Ma'mun's political and shrewd move, the 8th Imam alayhi salam drew up and implemented a divinely intelligent plan. This plan not only foiled the plot and requests of the ruling system, but it also led to the development of Quranic teachings and ideas and thoughts of the Holy Prophet's household throughout the world of Islam. With a great movement, with a reliance on Allah the Exalted, with divine wisdom and acumen, and with an efficient and wilayi outlook, the 8th Imam, God's greetings be upon him, managed to foil this hostile plot of a dictatorial and oppressive ruling system. He used it to the advantage of the truth. This is an outstanding chapter of the history of the Imams, alayhim as-salam.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The hunger strike of 6 Palestinian prisoners who have refused to eat for days have once again brought the plight of Palestinian prisoners to attention. The 6 are on hunger strike to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them.
Israeli prison authorities refuse to deal with the hunger strikers' legal demands. Kaed Al-Fosfos has been on a hunger strike for over 82 days. Mehdad Al-Ghawasmi for over 76 days, and both were transferred to Goplan Hospital. Ala Al-Araj as well has been transferred to Al-Ramlis Clinic. Their health condition is deteriorating, but they insist to continue with their move to end their illegal detention.
In solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah. Here, every week, you'll see prisoners' mothers and wives holding the pictures of their beloved ones. They say they are the voice of the prisoners.
My son Mujahid went on a hunger strike and ended it after the Israeli authorities decided not to renew his administrative detention and to release him. Mujahid spent almost 10 years in jail, and then he was rearrested after 15 months of release. His administrative detention has been renewed 3 times. That's why he started the open-ended hunger strike. I know he was risking his life, but that was only for the hope that he could be released to live with us, his family, and to raise his only child.
Administrative detention is illegal, however. It's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, with 520 of them under the illegal administrative detention.
Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoner follows the same path in the future. Unfortunately, Israel ends the administrative detention only when hunger-striking prisoners are on the verge of death. Muna Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Tensions between China and Taiwan have once again escalated after Taipei reported that 148 Chinese fighter jets flew over the island's air defense zone since Friday. That was a day Beijing marked the founding of the People's Republic of China with a military parade. Taiwanese government officials said they have to be on alert for China's, quote, military activities, while Taiwan's president Tsai Ing-wen said the island would do what it took to defend itself. This is China regards a self-ruled island, a breakaway province waiting to be reunited with the mainland. It maintains sovereignty over the region under the One China policy. However, Taiwan says it's an independent country and seeks help from the West, especially the United States, to boost its defense. Currently, the U.S. is Taiwan's largest weapons supplier, despite having no formal ties with the island. On Monday, China once again lashed out at the U.S. for selling arms to Taiwan and sending its warship to the Taiwan Strait. The foreign ministry described Washington's actions as provocative and irresponsible and urged it to stop bolstering Taiwanese separatist forces. Some experts believe the U.S. is hatching plot to further push Taiwan into secession from China.
The U.S. is trying to push the envelope as far as possible, trying all kinds of tactics and measures to push Taiwan forward as if it was a separate country without declaring its former status as a separate country.
The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally,